At our last meeting, we were considering the traditional proofs of God that had been common currency among philosophers in Europe, Western Europe and North America, and Kant's critique of those arguments in the sense of evaluation. He's going to show you why they don't work. And the last one that we had been covering was Paley's argument from design, or to design, the watch and the watchmaker. What would you think if you had never seen a watch and you stumbled on it and looked at how all the parts work together in order to turn the hands on the face, and the hands of the face correspond to the hours of the day? Would you think that was a natural accident produced that, or that it was the product of intelligent design? Now, Hume thought about that argument as well, and he had an objection. So we'll cover his as well. But since I started with Kant, let's continue and just get his down. First, he says, designer is not creator. You may want to say this is God, but you haven't shown me there's a creator of the world. Whatever this designer is, could just be a cosmic interior decorator. It makes things better than they'd otherwise be, and a lot of the evidence of the design and the thought that goes into that is these things exhibit, but we don't know anything else about the designer. And we don't know it is also creator. We don't know that the designer is good. We don't know that there's only one designer. Hume said, when I look at some parts of the universe, I think they may have been planned by a committee, because they're pretty messed up. Okay. There's also an objection by a guy named Venn, who's the inventor of the Venn diagrams. And I'll show you that one in just a moment. Finish. With Kant says it not only doesn't show us creator or any other attribute of divinity, of God. That's the best way, of God. So all it gets you is at least one designer. That's all, that's the most this argument can get you, and you know nothing else about the designer. It's intelligent. It can design things. And the design's pretty clever. We admire the way the parts of living things interacts us to keep the organism alive, and so on. That much, maybe. But there are other objections as well, and I find Venn's far more difficult to answer than anybody else's. And Venn believed in God. That's not the problem. It's the question is whether this proof works. Then says, in order to know whether a proof works, we would first have to know the ratio of designed to undesigned things in the universe. Why would you need to know that? Well, suppose by your calculations, the chances of A, whatever thing A is, being an accident is 1 in 10 million. Wouldn't that be a convincing argument that this must be designed? And Venn says, no, it wouldn't. Because if there are more undesigned things in the universe, then 1 in 10 million, then it's still more likely not designed. So if ratio of designed to undesigned is 1 in 100 million. No, it's going to be, one in, let's say 10,000. If the ratio of designed to unthinked is greater, there you go, then it's still more likely that the thing's undesigned than designed. I hope you're able to follow that. You'd have to first know how many, the ratio of designed to non-designed things in the world. If the ratio of undesigned things is that it's 1 in 10 billion, that it's undesigned. For everything that's designed, there are 10 billion things that aren't. Then finding out that the probability of A, whatever A is supposed to be, the human brain or something else, is 1 in 10 million, will not all by itself be convincing. Because if for everything that's designed there are 10 billion things, then being 1 in 10 million isn't convincing. You'd have to show that the chances are even less than 1 in 10 billion. So this argument actually doesn't work unless you can show what the ratio of designed to undesigned things is in the universe, and Venn then points out that you can't know that unless you already know whether God exists, because if God exists, there are no undesigned things in the universe at all. And if he doesn't, they're all undesigned. Or almost all. Let's say that the things that humans and intelligent animals plan and carry out would be designed things. There'd be some, but there'd be way more things and events that take place in the entire universe than the number of things done by humans and higher apes and so on. I think that's a very devastating argument. But anyway, Kant was convinced it didn't work because it didn't give you God. It gave you something you know not what, or some things you know not what, that planned some of the stuff of the universe. Venn has an even better objection, in my opinion. So I don't think this succeeds either. And anyway, I don't believe for a second that reason, that what people believe in God because of arguments. There's a text in the New Testament that says to us, that warns us that they won't. The natural man will not receive the things of the Spirit of God because they are discerned spiritually. And he can't know them, that means know that they're true, because they're spiritually discerned. Unless God's Spirit takes away the blindness of one's heart, no one will ever see a good reason for believing in God. There may be a convincing argument somewhere convincing to somebody. But even if it initially is, the reply you'll get is, well, I don't know what's wrong with this argument, but something is, because it concludes with something I don't believe and don't want to, and I won't. But that text warns us that the natural man will not receive, and it says cannot receive the things of God unless the Holy Spirit brings God's grace to the heart, repairs it so that it now can see the truth about the origin of all things, that it's God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. not alone, as the creator and designer of the universe. So, Hume, of course, once said that there's enough disharmony in the world that I think it looks like it was designed by a committee. Well, that's a funny joke, but that's a point too. The people that argue that you can prove God by appealing to the intelligent design exhibited by some things won't have that. They insist on it. But they can't show that it was only one designer, or that the designer cares about humans. In fact, loves humans and wants to rescue them from sin and death. There's nothing that gets them that far. So, in my opinion, still, God is not a proper object of proof. But not because ideas, the categories of the understanding apply only to sensations, but because God created the laws of proof and isn't subject to them, except in ways that he specifically allows them to govern the relations he creates to humans and to the rest of his creation. I think that's enough time spent on that subject. I will come back to what I think are the proper grounds, the actual grounds for belief in God on the part of people who do believe. We'll close with that. I won't let that slide by. We'll return to this. But for now, we've done Kant enough that we need to turn to the next big subject in Kant, and that's Kant's account. Sorry. All right, we'll start over. Kant's ethics. Kant wanted to save science and ethics from Hume's devastating critique. He thinks now that he's saved science because necessity or necessary connection is guaranteed by one of the categories of the understanding. It's something the mind imposes on all experience. That things are connected in many ways, but one of them is the invariable sequence of A to B. And I pointed out that that doesn't save causality at all, because real causality is that A produces B, not just that B always shows up whenever A is around. All the mind is said to do by Kant is ensure that B will always follow A. But why? Because the mind makes it so, not because A produces B. So it's not real causality. Now let's see if he can do something better with ethics. What's he going to do with to save that there are ethical rules? And to do that, he proposes that there is a rule for knowing whether any action that you contemplate doing is morally right or morally wrong. And this rule he calls the categorical imperative. For Kant, everything has to have a fancy name and it has to be strange. Categorical just means it allows no exceptions. And imperative means it's a command to us. You might think he means a command from God. No, he does not. When he's doing his ethics, God's just an idea of the reason. So that's not where it comes from. It comes from reason. It comes from our rational nature. Reason itself commands us not to do what is evil, and to do the good. Okay, how does it do that? Well, the categorical imperative is take the maxim of your action means, in effect, the description of the action. As a universal law. So if we wrote down, if we apply this to the case of lying, if I'm considering telling a lie, what I'm supposed to do is take the description of this action and write it as a universal law. If I did that, I would get universal law means that think that what would happen if all statements were false, right? I'm contemplating or offering a false statement. No, I was not down there last night, okay? When I jolly well was. Now, if I take the description of this and universalize it, make it into what, like a law of nature or a law of logic or something, now I make it true of every, what's true of this statement, namely it's a lie, true of every statement. Suppose they were all like that. All statements are false. Now, Kant says that's self-contradictory. I'm going to use the term self-defeating. Why is it self-defeating? Well, if all statements were false, so would this statement be, that all statements are false. And when you meet something like that, you know it's a wrong action. In other words, logical consistency is the test for ethical rightness. And you say, is this going to cover everything that's wrong? Everything that's wrong is going to turn out to be self-defeating or self-contradictory, blows itself up. And immediately after using the example of a lie, or not long later, he uses another example of keeping a promise. Suppose what I'm tempted to do is break a promise. If I universalize that, I write it down as though it were a law, I have to write down all promises are broken. What's the matter with that one? Well, says Kant, if this were a law of reality, a law of nature, then there would be no such thing as a promise. Now, this example is important for a couple of reasons. First, it shows that though he initially said the categorical imperative would show that if we universalize, wrote as a law of nature, whatever the act is we're contemplating doing, it would turn out to be self-contradictory. But this goes beyond self-contradictory, right? It doesn't contradict itself to say there are no promises, or all promises are broken. It's inconsistent with the kind of world we live in. We live in a world where promises are possible, and at least sometimes they're kept. So it's inconsistent with the way the world is now, but that's not what he said the criterion was at first. Okay, so he's expanded it a bit. So what we have to do is see that fact and say, redefine this categorical imperative. The categorical imperative tells us that if we write the maxim of our act as a universal law, It will either be self-contradictory or defeat itself in other, some other way, or it will be incompatible with the way the world really is now. And that's the third one that we get out of this example. There would be no such thing as promises. Now, especially among empiricists, this categorical imperative has been frequently misunderstood. John Dewey, for example, in his book, Theory of the Moral Life, says that Kant tells us on one page that we can't look at what happens in the world as a consequence of our experience or of our actions to tell us whether the act is right or wrong. We can't look at the rest of the world and say, well, suppose everybody did that. Then what a mess there'd be. Now, that's not what shows it's wrong. What shows it's wrong is when we write it as a universal law, it defeats itself or is inconsistent with the way the world is. Right? But Dewey misunderstands that. He thinks that's what Kant is doing. He says of Kant on one page, he says, we can't weigh in the consequences of the world of our act. And in the next page, he says, well, what if everybody did that? That's not what Kant means by universal law. He doesn't mean, what if everybody did that? He means, what if that's a law of nature? So he's not looking at what would happen as a consequence of my action. According to Kant, I'm never supposed to consider what the consequence will be of what I do in order to tell whether it's right or evil, good or bad. I'm only supposed to look at the categorical imperative to tell me whether reason commands me to do it or commands me not to. Well, Dewey just missed him on that. But a lot of other people have too. See, and this it's shown by this example here. What does he say about all promises are broken? If that was a law of nature, he doesn't say then business couldn't take place because nobody would keep to a contract and people would break their marriage vows and people would break this, that, and the other. They would be free then to do not to keep any promise they ever make. No, that's not what he says. He says there'd be no such thing as a promise. Because if it's a law of nature that as soon as anyone makes a promise, they don't keep it, there are no such things as promises. They're totally useless. They're like saying, I wish I had my own dragon. So that's important. This example is important because it both shows that he's expanded the categorical imperative and because it shows that the people who construe the categorical imperative as meaning what would happen if everybody did this are wrong. That's not what he meant. Now, there are still things that don't turn out to be wrong on this expanded view. And there are actually a lot of them. Suppose I've found a way to rob the bank I'm working for. And it's a way that no one will ever discover. The bank, for the next 100 years, is not going to ever be able to find out that I skimmed this money. It has no bad consequences. It's not going to cause a depression if I swipe $100,000 over a few months and just don't say anything to anybody. Why would that turn out to be wrong? Well, does the categorical imperative cover that? If we write that down as a law of nature, everybody steals what isn't theirs. I'm not sure that that's self-contradictory. And the only reason that it's not true of the world we live in, it often is, But it's not always true of the world we live in, is that a lot of people believe that stealing is wrong. So it's iffy whether consistency with the way the world is. I mean, it's possible to be honest and not steal money, that's right. But anyway, Kant's troubled by some of these things. Here's another one that's clearly not covered. Somebody's rude to somebody else. They're disturbingly rude and mean when they don't need to be. And it hurts the other person. We're not allowed to say it's wrong because it hurt the other person. Right? We're not allowed to say it's wrong because that offends God. That's not the way God wants us to treat one another. It has to be inconsistent with the way the world is. It isn't. People could. It's not, I mean, I would say it's not self-contradictory, and it's not self-defeating. Now, made as into a law, it means everybody insults everybody else all the time. That's, in fact, not the way the world is, but it could be. There's nothing inconsistent with the way the world is that would prevent everybody from doing this. It could be. It's not inconsistent with the way the world is. In fact, the world isn't this way, but this wouldn't be incompatible. But it would still be wrong. I mean, we have it from our Lord himself. He said, anyone who says to someone else, you fool, is not going to be guiltless at the judgment. Warning taken. But Kant was nervous about all that, so he came up with a second form of the categorical imperative. And this one reads, always treat others as ends and not means. And this gets a lot more of what he wanted. Always treat others as ends, not means. In our planning, we have goals that we want to achieve. Maybe there are certain goals that I want to achieve just for today, or by next month, or sometime in the next year. That's okay. We think out means to accomplish those ends. Some of the means may be get out there and do hard work. Some of the other means may be really kind to so-and-so. It doesn't matter. We're not to treat other humans as merely means to an end. But every human being is an end in themselves, ethically. So the other human beings should be our goals, to relate to them properly and kindly and lovingly and caringly, so on. But never as just a means to accomplish an end. And that kind of talk gets you a lot further toward, closer to the Christian standard, which is love your neighbor as yourself. It's not clear that it gets you past tolerance. It seems to me tolerance would satisfy this. I tolerate other people and their differences, no matter what those are. And so I tolerate people if they are different skin color, they speak a different language, come from a different background, they like different things, and so on. And I'm completely tolerant now of all of that. That means I accept them the way they are. That, it seems to me, would fulfill this. it does not seem to me that it gets to the point of commanding love of them. So it's not the same as the Christian standard. The Christian standard isn't that I just tolerate my neighbor, it's that I love my neighbor, that I seek the good of what my neighbor, what is good for him, and that I balance my own self-interest, I love myself, that's okay, as my neighbor, as I do my neighbor. There's a balance and equality. They're human too. Now, let me illustrate this difference this way. If I try to tolerate people and I fail, then that can result in some pretty nasty stuff. I can end in death camps. But if I try to live up to love your neighbor and I fail, then I might still have tolerance. The failure of love doesn't have to go all the way to hate. It can be tolerant. But the failure of tolerance does result in hate. If I looked at the differences in my neighbors and I can't stand them, I don't like those things, and I don't like anybody those things are true of, that can rapidly descend into hatred and can descend into laws that outlaw the things those people are different from me in ways they're different from me. So I don't think this ethic ever quite comes up to the Christian standard for the reasons I've tried to explain. Kant gives at least three discernible versions of the categorical imperative. If a statement, when universalized, is self-contradictory, or if it's incompatible, would make the world a different world from the one we have, it would be a world in which there's no such thing as a promise. I mean, why would anyone make them if it's a law that as soon as you make a promise, it's broken? Then nobody bother making them. They're not possible. Because the point of the promise is that someone's going to carry it out. And that's impossible in this world where the second form of the categorical imperative applies. So he comes up with a third, and this is closer, I grant you, but it still doesn't get to love your neighbor. It doesn't get to that level. I will add this one comment. We're commanded to love people whether or not we like them. That's not the same thing. There are certainly people I like and I have as friends, and there are other people I really dislike being around, and I avoid them. But I still have to love them in the Christian sense of seeking their good balanced with mine. So it is, we can love people that we don't particularly like. And that's not the same as mere tolerance, and certainly not the same as hatred. We still owe those whom we don't particularly like or enjoy being around love in the Christian sense of, and you know the Greek word for that is agape, balancing our interests. There may be some self-sacrifice involved in that, but it doesn't command that we always sacrifice ourselves in favor of the other guy. That's not what it's saying. As yourself, you love. Okay. I think this gets us at the heart of Kantian ethics. I will say this about it. At least he went for rules, right? He thinks there are hard and fast rules. And unlike the tradition of utilitarian ethics, which just says, look at the consequences of this action, make a judgment about what sort of, is it the sort of action that will produce the most pleasure for the most people? If so, it's good. If it produces more pain for more people than pleasure, it's evil. So look at the consequences of the act. That's the only thing that can tell you whether an action is good or bad. Kant says, don't look at the consequences of the act. What tells you whether it's good or bad is the categorical imperative. That is the moral law. For him, the moral law is not the Ten Commandments. It's act so as to treat people always as an end and never as a means to ends. So you don't use them and trample them and leave them in the dust. This forbids dog-eat-dog kind of competition where everybody is everyone at odds with everyone else. Everyone else is their foe. His law does forbid that, but it doesn't get to love your neighbor. Okay. I think we've finished that one too. I won't go on about the just the Kantian ethic. It does give us a rule. It gives us a law. It gives us something to follow. And today, the big divide in ethics is still between Kant's or Kant-like ethics that are rule-based and that say you have a duty to obey them, and utilitarian ethics that weigh pleasure and pain. That's the big divide in ethics these days. There's another group that's advocating the revival of a virtue ethics, something like Aristotle's. But rather than cover all of that, I'm just pointing out the ways in which Kant differs, and the people who like that sort of thing love it and call themselves some kind of Kantian, and that means there are definite rules. Now, one of the troubles with these is that Kant sees the rules as exceptionless. Now, I made this point before about Christian ethics. There's an axiom, we may call it that. The fundamental truth of ethics is love your neighbor as yourself. The rules that we have are things like don't lie, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't murder, don't be envious of your neighbor, and so on. They're in the Ten Commandments. But they have exceptions. There are times I might have to kill somebody who's attempting to slaughter my wife and children. Or, like the professor I knew who lived in Nazi Germany during the war, I have to lie to the Gestapo to save the Jews I'm rescuing from the Nazi prison camps and that are in my basement. So I tell the Gestapo, no, I haven't seen anybody, and my basement's full of people I'm helping escape. That is good. That's a lie, but it's good. It's the thing I should do. The law of love overrides any of the specific rules. Kant can't say that. He's backed himself into a corner where it's reason itself in the form of the categorical imperative that commands us. And out of respect for the moral law, out of respect for the laws that make up or that are part of my rationality, which is what it is to be a human, I must obey it in all circumstances. So does that mean I should say to the Gestapo officer, yes, my basement's filled with them. Here, arrest me for helping them to escape and go ahead and machine gun them all. And Kant's answer is you tell the truth no matter what. Consequences don't decide anything. And people kept saying that they couldn't believe that, that anybody would say that. So he wrote a little pamphlet kind of thing later on in his life. And he said, oh, yes, I do. Now listen to this line. He wrote, I would not lie, no, not to save mankind. Now that kind of stuff pushes being good so far that it ends up being evil. You wouldn't save the whole of mankind by telling the Gestapo officer a lie. I don't think he deserves the truth because of what he stands for. But anyway, Christianity isn't in that hole. It's God who gives the commands. And it's God who sets the law of love above them. Those commands are what violates the law of love in the vast majority of instances and circumstances. Acting out of love will be keeping those rules. But they can be violated and still be in conformity to the axiom of love. And there's one more thing I think I ought to at least comment on before we close out Kant's ethics. And that is an old dilemma that he answers in a particular way. The old dilemma goes under the name the Euthyphro dilemma. Euthyphro is a person. He's one of the characters in, the lead character in one of Plato's dialogues called Euthyphro. So in this dialogue, this question is raised. And they're talking about justice, but it applies as well to love. It applies to ethics and to the law. And here's the way that's raised in Plato's day. Do the gods command what is good? Because it is good. Or is what is good good because the gods command it? Now we can substitute God for gods, and we can ask, does God command us, say, not to steal and not to lie, because that's already evil? That's something that good and evil are already there. They're already values. And God commands us to do the good rather than the evil. Or is it good because God commands it? Is it evil because God commands us not to do it? So are theft and lying wrong because God says don't do them? Might he just as well have said, don't eat bananas? And then that would be evil too. Now the first one seems to make what's good and evil independent of God. God picks the one, says do the one rather than the other. Don't do the other. Or is it that God makes them good and evil? Makes good and evil what they are and commands us. They turn out to be wrong because God commands against it. And something turns out to be good because God says do it. And I think that the way that's phrased, that whole problem is phrased, is in such a way that the Christian answer is neither. The Ten Commandments are not making anything evil. In They are revelation. Not legislation. Or not new legislation. Not new legislation. They are telling us, they are revealing to us how God created the world. God created the world and us so that these things are evil. Don't do them. Some, of course, are good and we're commanded to do them, such as honor your father and your mother. And it begins, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So we're commanded both to do some things and not to do others. But this isn't, for the first time, making these things so. This is, along with all the rest of Scripture, revelation to us that gives us the truth about God and about ourselves and the world we live in. How did it get to be that the world is such that it's really wrong to steal and it's really right to honor your parents? God made it that way. So it's not true independent of God. Doesn't have some other origin. No, I think that's the right way to answer this dilemma. And a lot of people are really troubled by it. But see, Plato didn't have any idea of a transcendent creator who creates the entirety of the rest of reality out of nothing and makes it just the way he wants to make it. And when his creatures don't worship him and fall into sin, and they need to be rescued from sin and death. And then he actually comes incarnate into the world to help rescue them. I want to read you, in closing, what Kant says about that idea. Because of these things that he has said previously, thus determined about the original being, we must not think of him merely as a legislative or intelligent nature. We should think this original being as all-knowing. Well, he's already ruled out that we can do that. Why should we think of him that way? In our inmost dispositions, we constitute the proper moral worth of our actions as rational beings in the world. We will not be hid from him. We shall think of him as almighty. Thus he'll be able to make the whole of nature accord with this highest purpose. We shall think of him as all good, and so on. He goes on. But why in the world would we do that? You've already told us we can't know that. But he said, live as if God is real. But God's what? Why would God be the answer to all these things? I mean, it's stolen right out of Christianity, that's all. It's the prevailing religion where I live, which it was in Germany, was Christianity. So, and it's not a successful plea, but it's appropriate to say that this archetype of God has come down to us from heaven and has assumed our humanity. Whoa, what's he going to say about this? This ideal of moral perfection we can represent to ourselves only as the idea of a person. So no real person came down from heaven. It's only the idea of that person. Man can frame to himself no concept of the degree, strength, or force like that of moral disposition, except by picturing it as encompassed by obstacles and yet in the face of them overcoming them. So the only way we, poor sorry humans, even though we're rational, can get the idea of moral perfection is from the idea of a morally perfect person being confronted with obstacles and temptations and overcoming them. So that's the way we should think about this. We therefore need no actual empirical example to make this our pattern. No real person has to come down and be incarnate on earth. And no conformity to it demands that this individual should have performed miracles or had them performed for him. He who demands this thereby confesses his moral unbelief. And that is a great lack of faith. Now, if it were indeed a fact that such a godly-minded man at some particular time had descended, as it were, from heaven to earth and had given men his own person through his teachings, his conduct, his sufferings, as perfect example of a man well pleasing to God as one can expect to find. For be it remembered that this is an archetype of such a person, is to be sought nowhere but in our own reason. There isn't a real person, it's just our idea. And if he had gone through all this and produced immeasurably great good upon earth by effecting a revolution in the human, it should be effecting, it's a misprint, effecting this revolution in the human race, even then we should have no cause for supposing him other than a natural man, naturally begotten. This is not, to be sure, absolutely to deny that he might be a supernatural person, but to suppose this can in no way benefit us practically. So there you have Kant's verdict on Christianity. It's a bunch of ideas. Think about them and live as though they were true, but know that they're not. The idea, we could say, as it were, descended from heaven, and we think of all this, and it's the example of a perfect, morally perfect person living to God. And that's the way we should. But don't think that's a real person or that really happened. No, that's not true. And that's his ultimate verdict. Pretty sad, huh? I think so. And we'll continue with him next time.